This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
I'm Professor Richard Gershon from the University of Mississippi School of Law, host of In Legal Terms. If you're enjoying this podcast, I encourage you to listen to In Legal Terms, the show about you and your rights. We find interesting legal topics to bring to you and let you know how the law affects you. Find In Legal Terms on any podcasting platform on your smart device or on our website, inlegalterms.mpbonline.org.
MPB Think Radio, this is Money Talks. I'm Kevin Farrell, here with Dr. Nancy Lotcher-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. Nancy and Ryder aren't in the studio this week, so we aren't taking phone calls. Instead, we'll re-air some recent conversations from the show. And in this first part, we discuss saving for retirement. So, Ryder, let's start with you. What do you think is a reasonable goal for retirement savings?
So that's always a funny question. Because it totally depends on you. It depends on what is the lifestyle you want to live, how long you are planning on being in retirement. So that would be if you're retiring earlier, you're going to be in retirement longer. If you're retiring later or planning to die at your desk, then you're going to be retired for less time. We often on this show say save 15 to 20% of your income over a 30 to 40 year working career, and getting that prudently invested is probably going to cover a lot of your needs. You also maybe have Social Security. Some people have a pension. Of course, the higher your income, the more you are responsible for covering that in retirement, because Social Security is weighted a little towards the lower income brackets and does have some maximums there.
So, Nancy, is it reasonable to expect that you could have a similar quality of life in retirement than you did while working?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And again, back to what Ryder said, it depends on how do you want to live in retirement. I will say, Kevin, that we work with a lot of Mississippi State employees, and more often than not, they end up drawing more in retirement than when they were working. And so that's an interesting situation. Having a really good retirement plan available to you is very valuable.
When you start a job, is that probably a good time to go ahead and start something up?
Yeah.
Yes. And a lot of retirement, when you start a job, a lot of retirement plans do have some sort of, when you're thinking about the tax benefits of them, do have some sort of, you have to have earned income. You have to have earned income to contribute to an IRA. Of course, if you have an employer plan, you would have to be employed. If you just have maybe some income here and there, you can be saving in just a regular taxable account, but because it does not have to be a retirement-specific account that you save into.
Let's back up and talk about these two types of employer plans. You have something called a defined benefit plan, Kevin, and that's a pension. And so those benefits are going to be defined by how long you work and what your salary level was during those working years. And it's a calculation that says, Kevin, when you retire, we will pay you X number of dollars every month for the rest of your life. That's how a pension will work. In that case, employers are taking on all the risk because they're having to invest that money for you. So that is PERS. It comes out automatically out of your paycheck. But the state of Mississippi matches a large amount with that, and so puts that money aside for you and prepares for you. And they have actuaries that try to figure out how long you're going to be living and how long they will have to pay you. All of those are wonderful benefits. But those have basically disappeared for most of us out there. And that happened in the mid-70s because there were changes in the laws that required these defined benefit plans to be funded in a certain way. So employers started to do away with those. And then we had defined contribution plans. Those are the 401Ks, the 403Bs. Those numbers and letters come from the IRS code. But a defined contribution plan, your benefits are going to be defined by you. How much did you put into the plan? How did you invest it? That defined contribution plan, then the risk all lands on the employee. If you don't save enough, if you don't invest it properly enough, then you don't have enough. And whatever you accumulate during those years, that's what you have, and that's what you're going to have to live on. Then we have IRAs, which are like defined contribution plans, but they are outside of employer retirement plans. So the I stands for individual. We get the question all the time, can I put my spouse's name on my IRA? No, you cannot. That's what the I stands for. It is an individual retirement account. And so we have different types of those.
But a couple could each have an IRA. Each spouse could have an IRA.
Yes, yes.
That's so interesting. So the 70s, you said, is when the changes started. And so can one person have more than one IRA?
Yes, and a couple of ways of thinking about that. There are a couple of types of IRAs. There's not just the traditional IRA and the Roth IRA, but maybe your employer has a SEP IRA, or if you're self-employed, or your employer, if it's a small employer, has a simple IRA. Then, of course, you can just have even just one of those types. Say you just have a traditional IRA. You can have them at various institutions, various custodians, various banks. Sometimes people have that just because through the years they've been encouraged to open one here, there. They opened one to take advantage of some deal, and they just didn't consolidate along the way. And a lot of times when people come to us and they have seven different statements, and we're like, how about we turn this into one statement for you going forward?
Just because the IRS looks at it as one pile of money.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're not keeping good track of it, then you just want to be careful, because you don't get additional contributions just because you have two. You still have the IRS says, well, no, that was just an IRA contribution. You only get one of them.
Nancy, what's a traditional IRA?
Well, a traditional IRA means it is tax deferred. That means you get a tax break on the amount you put into it. So it reduces your current income for federal income tax purposes and state income if you do have that advantage. But when you take it out later, you're going to have to pay taxes at that point. So the idea was that when you retire, you will probably be in a lower income tax bracket. We find that's not necessarily the case, because people still want to live well. And these were created in 1974. That was the ERISA law. That was also the change from the pensions over to the 401ks. All of that happened. It's all connected in that period of time. And so a lot of people have just used this as a tax planning way. You can do a traditional IRA on top of your 401k. Whether or not you get a tax deduction depends on your income. So there are lower income limits depending on if you're single or if it's a joint filer. So check with your CPA or whoever does your taxes to see if you qualify for a tax break on a traditional IRA.
I got this buddy who graduated from Ole Miss, and he's done real well and made a lot of money. And he's got this little purse dog like Paris Hilton had.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll spend like $65 on a Ole Miss jersey to fit this dog.
And what but I it's so small. It's a small jersey. Surely they can't charge $65 for such a small jersey.
I think he was even bragging about spending that much on it, like a Betty Moore, an Ole Miss fan or something. But anyway, I've been telling him I think what he should do with his money, not that he's asked me, but what I think he should do with his money is invest in land in Canada, maybe preferably northern Canada. And I was just curious, is there any drawbacks or advantages as far as taxes from investing one's money in foreign land?
Foreign land, so there are a lot of tax benefits in the United States for investing in real estate. Investing in just raw land with no development on it, maybe a little less so, but there are the business of America is real estate. There for landlords, for people who buy buildings, for people who develop buildings, all sorts of rungs on that ladder. There are a ton of tax benefits. You know, one of them being
say you buy a building and you rent it out, you can expense a lot of the things that go into it. You can expense, there's depreciation, which some people use to reduce their income to next to nothing. Of course, you get the income from renting it out. You get the price appreciation. There are ways to sell appreciated real estate and property without actually paying the taxes that you would really owe. I mean, there are just all sorts of tax benefits. I don't know how much that extends to foreign land. Of course, the foreign whatever tax regime is in Canada is going to be different from ours in there, and it does depend on the country you're in, because there's lots of tax agreements between countries.
Yeah, and you need to check if you're going to invest in another country. You need to find out what their rules are. Will they allow you to invest? In some cases, you have to be a citizen, or you have to go through a special entity in order to do that. So you need to check on that on the front end, and then what happens as far as taxes. Our experience in dealing with some people that we have worked with who've been in Canada and then moved to the U.S. is that Canada likes to get their share. And so yes. Be careful with all of that.
And so it was just kind of funny that he mentioned buying land in Northern Canada. Because there was years ago, and I was trying to find it, there was years ago, I believe it was the Canadian government sold a port, which was like the northernmost port in Canada, because it was frozen in year round.
Yeah.
And so they sold it, but because as the oceans warm,
this like the selling the Brooklyn Bridge,
maybe, right. But it's kind of like selling something which may become a valuable asset in the future. I don't know the full story there, but that's what came to mind. I thought he was trying to buy an iced in port.
The other caution about investing in real estate in real property is it is not as liquid as a stock, a bond, your savings account. I'm always saying you can't break off that brick or pick up a pile of dirt and take it down to the grocery store to pay your bills. And the value of it, well, I can't just look at it up online very easily. Like I can look up my stock and I know any point in the day what it is worth. That can fluctuate. And, for most people, you can't just sell part of it. You have to sell the whole thing. Versus if I own shares of stock, if I own 1,000 shares of Apple, I can sell 10 shares of Apple and get the cash that I need. I can't quite do that with most pieces of property.
Well, let me ask y'all. I appreciate that, and that all makes sense to me. But is there any tax benefit in buying a $65 miniature Ole Miss jersey on first off?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, good. I'm gonna pass that along.
Yeah. Unless now I have thought of one thing. Unless you
use
that dog as part of your marketing campaign
on
your business.
Oh my goodness.
There you go.
I was gonna say we got to be real careful about this fine line between great advice and tax fraud.
Thanks a lot, y'all.
You're listening to Money Talks. I'm Kevin Farrell, and my co-hosts are Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. Nancy and Ryder aren't in the studio this morning, so we're re-airing some recent conversations we've had on the program. This segment starts with Nancy talking about whether to use a debit or credit card.
The merchant is going to have to pay on any card transaction, depending on whether it's debit or credit, anywhere from 1 to 4%. It could be that high as 4%. If you do your debit cards, then that is going to be a lower charge to the merchant. But, of course, we always are cautioning our listeners when they use the debit card, then you have no way of saying, oh, gosh, no, that wasn't me, because that money is immediately swiped out of your account. So we would prefer you to use that credit card. But more and more, Kevin, I'm seeing the same thing happening where these smaller businesses are saying, look, we can't afford that extra charge. We can't raise our fees to compensate for that. So we're going to add it at the register. And so that hopefully is encouraging people to use more cash. At the same time, I don't see a lot of people using cash, and I certainly don't carry as much cash as I used to, and we're looking for maybe other ways of handling that. But the credit card companies are making money with every swipe, everywhere you go.
So in your opinion, is that a fair charge? Is it, I mean, is that the amount of money that it costs to do? I mean, I guess it's the electronic transfer or whatever, but I mean, is it a fair charge in your mind?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. Certainly, you know, MasterCard and Visa, they're making a lot of money. And they don't have to lower that fee. If you are a local company, you might be able to negotiate for something less than 4% on those card transaction fees. But bigger companies like a Walmart, they certainly have lower fees that they deal with. But you still have to be able to manage that and manage the movement of money. And also, they're taking the risk that when you swipe your MasterCard or Visa, that you're going to pay that bill. What happens if you don't pay that bill? So they have to account for all of that.
You want your financial advisor to be transparent about any fees that they might charge.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most important thing you can ask when you look for a financial advisor, if you're looking for professional help, is how are you paid? And there are three different ways that advisors are paid. They may be paid by a fee only, that's what my company does, which could be based on their time, an hourly fee, or it could be based on how much money you're asking them to manage, a percentage of that, for instance. The other end of that would be commission advisors, and there are a lot of good commission advisors out there, but you just need to understand that that's how they are paid. They are paid by the companies that they're selling those securities to you with, and so those companies are paying that advisor, but again, it's sort of back to that gets passed on to you, even though it's not explicitly listed, it does get passed on to you as the investor. And so you just need to understand that their commission may vary depending on the product or the investment in which they put you in. So read the fine print of anything that you're handed, ask that question. And then the third way is a combination of the two. It is fee-based. So there may be some hourly or percentage fee as well as some commission product in the meantime. So just make sure you understand how that person is being paid. There could be some conflict of interest in what they are suggesting to you.
Got a couple more qualities to talk about, but we do have a caller on the line. So we want to say good morning to Roger, who calls in from Florence. Go ahead, Roger. You're on the air with us.
Good morning. Good show. Thank you for your clarity. I'd like you to compare, and they're not, it's very different, but compare and discuss, again, credit card implications for the individual, but also compare that with debit cards. To me, it looks simple. You give them your money, they make interest off of it, and then you get your money back in pieces as you take it out of your credit card. The ads make it sound real good, but it's your money, and it's, and you could have it in your pocket rather than give it to them and let them. So would you comment on those two things? Because I think the public is probably gullible on that.
Right, because with both a debit card and a credit card, we're just pulling a piece of plastic out of our wallets, or we're using our phone to tap, and off we go. But these are two very different processes. So a debit card, that as soon as you swipe that card, your bank account is immediately grabbed, that money is grabbed out of your bank account, and it's gone. So if something happens and it's erroneous, somebody used your card, you're going to have to then deal with your bank. You're going to have to wait for them to do an investigation, and if it turns out it was not you, then they will put the money back. Yes, you'll get the money back, but it's gone on the front end. If you use a credit card, it is a loan. So you are basically buying money from the credit card company. They're going to charge you interest if you let it go longer than the bill paying cycle. And so it's not your money that's gone. And so if somebody takes your credit card and uses it incorrectly, you can immediately say when you get that statement, that was not me. I am not going to pay that bill. I don't lose that money out of my account. And then that has to be resolved. And if they decide it wasn't you, it just disappears off of your statement. So there's, it's two very different processes. And because there's more risk for the credit card company with a credit card versus a debit, that's one of the reasons they're going to charge more to those vendors for every one of those swipes.
Kind of a follow-up on that. So as you said, most credit card companies will automatically – well, it seems like automatically. When you get a statement, you just say, well, I didn't buy that. I didn't charge that. Do they or can they do any sort of investigation to see that you're telling the truth?
Yes, they usually will. And of course, one of the things that I do now, and a lot of people will do this, I get alerts. So every time I use my credit card, even just to gas up the car or pay groceries, whatever, it pops on my phone. And that is to protect the credit card company because they want to know immediately if there's been a problem. So the quicker they can see something, they can shut it down and address those issues.
So we're talking about a couple of the qualities that would make a good financial advisor. So, Nancy, one thing that a piece of advice we've given on the air frequently is that it's a good idea to meet sort of in person with someone that you think is you might be your personal your financial advisor, that is, because they really need to understand, you know, what your financial goals are.
Right. And you need to be able to look that person in the eye. And these days that sometimes means we're doing that by Zoom. And really figure out, is this somebody I can trust and I can be comfortable with? Because it's really important if you work with a financial advisor that you put all your cards on the table. You know, you've got to be able to lay out your financial life, and sometimes that's a very intimate subject, to be able to put it all out there so that person can give you the best advice. And, you know, I cannot tell you, Kevin, the number of times I have people come in my office and say, oh, my gosh, I'm sure we're in the worst situation you have ever seen. And they put it all out there, and I'm thinking, no, I've seen worse. I need to know that, because if I don't have all the pieces of the puzzle, I can't make it all fit together nicely and develop a picture that works for that person and for that family. And so you need to be able to trust that person. You need to have a good fit personality-wise so that you can receive those recommendations and that advice, and you can work together and be able to reach your goals.
And then one last piece of advice, and it talks about financial jargon. So you don't want your financial advisor using a bunch of terms that you're not familiar with.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say sometimes I'm guilty of that. I'm probably do that on the radio, because every business, every job has its jargon, and you get into that mode and you jump into it and you don't even realize you're using it. But you need to try very hard not to. And if you meet with somebody and they use a lot of words that you don't understand, stop them. Ask them for explanations. And if you have somebody who just wants to drop a bunch of words in to make them sound big and good, then maybe you just need to go down the road.
So we're talking about a couple of the qualities that would make a good financial advisor. So, Nancy, one thing that a piece of advice we've given on the air frequently is that it's a good idea to meet sort of in person with someone that you think is you might be your personal your financial advisor, that is, because they really need to understand, you know, what your financial goals are.
Right. And you need to be able to look that person in the eye. And these days that sometimes means we're doing that by Zoom. And really figure out, is this somebody I can trust and I can be comfortable with? Because it's really important if you work with a financial advisor that you put all your cards on the table. You know, you've got to be able to lay out your financial life, and sometimes that's a very intimate subject, to be able to put it all out there so that person can give you the best advice. And, you know, I cannot tell you, Kevin, the number of times I have people come in my office and say, oh, my gosh, I'm sure we're in the worst situation you have ever seen. And they put it all out there, and I'm thinking, no, I've seen worse. I need to know that, because if I don't have all the pieces of the puzzle, I can't make it all fit together nicely and develop a picture that works for that person and for that family. And so you need to be able to trust that person. You need to have a good fit personality-wise so that you can receive those recommendations and that advice, and you can work together and be able to reach your goals.
And then one last piece of advice, and it talks about financial jargon. So you don't want your financial advisor using a bunch of terms that you're not familiar with.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say sometimes I'm guilty of that. I probably do that on the radio because every business, every job has its jargon, and you get into that mode and you jump into it and you don't even realize you're using it. But you need to try very hard not to. And if you meet with somebody and they use a lot of words that you don't understand, stop them. Ask them for explanations. And if you have somebody who just wants to drop a bunch of words in to make them sound big and good, then maybe you just need to go down the road.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. If you're discussing something and they use a term that you're not familiar with, please. And I would say this would apply not only to financial matters, but if you're visiting with your healthcare professional and they drop some sort of term that you're
anybody.
Not familiar with, you know, make sure you understand you're paying these people for information, and you want to make sure that you're getting the most out of your money.
Yeah, I mean, I had one with a healthcare issue. I was getting calls on results of a test. And this person kept saying, "Your PCP," and I'm nodding because I'm in my car and I'm in a hurry. And then I get off the phone. I'm like, "What's a PCP?" And I finally figured out it's primary care physician. Why wouldn't they say that?
Money Talks is MPB Think Radio's personal finance broadcast. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. Nancy and Ryder aren't in the studio this morning, so we're not taking phone calls. The next segment in this Best Of show starts with a listener call, followed by discussion of ways to save at the grocery store.
Good morning, Linda. You're on the air, so go ahead.
Are there any resources that people – I'm 69 years old. I work every day. I draw my Social Security. I have a nice flow of money, but – you know, sometimes staying on top and managing the resources are kind of hard. So I, at the age of 69, I guess I'm trying to learn good money management habits.
Well, I think there's some great books out there. If you want to learn about mutual funds, there's an older book, which is Bogle on Mutual Funds. Jack Bogle is father of the index mutual fund. He is no longer with us, but some great lessons there about how a mutual fund works. There are books on ETFs, exchange-traded funds. You can get basic personal finance books. Certainly, Susie Orman has written several. I don't agree with all of her things, just like I don't agree with all of Dave Ramsey's suggestions. Some of them are not very practical, but there's some good lessons in there. So any kind of good personal finance book, visit your local library. And, of course, there are online resources. So in any industry, there are terms and phrases that we use that you think, I don't know what that means. You can go online and look that up and figure out what those are. The Federal Reserve also has a lot of really good resources and videos that you can watch, videos on your credit score, all kinds of information out there. So there are a vast number of ways that you can learn.
Yeah, I was thinking one of the most important things is making sure you're getting information from a trustworthy source, and also just understanding what that source's point of view is. So government resources that are designed to help out citizens from the Federal Reserve or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau are great. A lot of banks do offer some sort of financial education or some sort of financial resource, but you have to understand also from their point of view, they are looking to gather customers. They want you to deposit money. They want you to take out loans. So it's maybe going to be geared more towards folks who are, for instance, taking out loans and using credit cards and things like that. But understanding the source and what their point of view is going to be important with any resource that you're digging into.
And I would add that one thing that we talk about frequently when it comes to budgeting, money management, that sort of thing, is you really first have to get a handle on where your money is going. So something as easy as a little spiral notebook or a notepad or something, maybe for a week, several days, however you want to do it, just every time you spend any kind of money, you know, jot something down. I went to the grocery store. I filled up my car with gas. I paid the power bill, that sort of thing. So I think if you do that over a week or so, you begin to get an idea of, you know, how much money you have and where it's going. And that way, some of these other resources we've been talking about become more meaningful because you can sort of apply them to your specific situation. Today, we're also talking about ways to save money at the grocery store. Next up on our list is coupons and loyalty programs. And I know that I have my Kroger card that I scan, and I find that that's very useful. There's always a lot of deals that you can get, you know, some $2 off of this, $3 off of that.
They certainly tell you at the end of your receipt that you saved a lot of money.
That's right. And I think
long receipt. Very long receipt.
They don't beat CVS for the longest receipt, though. Actually, I do think they might, but you're right. Every time at the bottom, they say you've saved this much money. The other thing that I think Kroger does a good job of, and I think it's because I use my little card, but now they've started sending me targeted coupons. Mm-hmm. And so, and usually there's something that's free in there, but those are valuable, and I use a lot of those. Nancy, what are your thoughts on coupons and loyalty cards, that sort of thing?
Well, I've tried them through the years. I've never been very good at them. I know some people are really good at couponing. Most of the time I find it's for products that I don't use. And like you, Kevin, seeing Kroger then send me coupons for things that I actually use, I can go through that list and go, well, I know I'm going to buy another one of these so I can put it in my purse and take it with me. And it does help to have those coupons now loaded online so it can be loaded on your card and you don't even have to think twice about it. So that helps. But, of course, bear in mind, they're trying to get you to buy more of a certain item, or at least in Kroger's case, probably get me to come back into the store to get that free item, and then I end up loading up my cart with everything else. But that's the name of the game. But you just have to be more disciplined with it. If you use those coupons, make sure that it's for something you do use or if it's something you want to try, try it once. But then don't get caught in that cycle.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think a lot of times because you get a coupon or a reduction in the price on something, you automatically want to buy it. And Ryder, as Nancy's saying, just double check, make sure this is really something that you need, and that's where you get the value of it, when it's something that you use that you're getting the cents off for or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't use it to buy more things, right? Don't be tempted just to spend more money just because, oh, I did spend $5, but I saved 50 cents. No. That means you spent more money. And Liz and I were talking about this before the show. There are some people who are very good at couponing. They find all these multiple coupons for the same item, or one's a specific item, one's a store coupon, one's a manufacturer's coupon. For some reason, I can never find all these incredible deals. So I don't end up playing that game. But like Nancy said, sometimes the apps where you can just preload them are very convenient. But always keep in mind, coupons are not designed to save you money. They are ads. They are promotional tools. So again, if it is not already on your list, that coupon is not saving you money.
Went to visit go ahead, Nancy.
I was going to say, I like the Dollar General at the bottom of your receipt. There will be a $5 off for the next Saturday if you buy $50. And so if you time it right, as far as all of your basics that you want to pick up at that time, that works well.
Was visiting some friends in California this last week, and we went by CVS. And as my friend was checking out, I kept hearing the computer voice saying, 5 cents off, 10 cents. I mean, he just had all these coupons, and he ended up getting like a $5 can of mixed nuts for $1. But it was funny because the computer voice kept saying, you're saving, what wasn't, but it's like, you're saving money. So coupons work, but there is a little bit of an effort. And what I like also, again, I think everybody's identified that I shop at groceries at Kroger, but they have the digital coupon. The only problem I have with that is it's a little bit hard sometimes to get my smartphone to look at the QR code, but that gets automatically loaded. And so when you scan your loyalty card, then those digital coupons are already on there, and they are subtracted from the totals. Good morning, Paul. You're on the air with us, so go ahead.
Good morning. I have a question about some Series E U.S. savings bonds. I've purchased them over several years through my employer. They're going to start reaching maturation in the next year or so. What should I do with them? Any recommendations?
Whose name is on those?
Mine.
Yours. Okay.
Yes.
In that case, probably you're just going to take them to the bank and cash them out, because you don't want to hang on to them until after maturity, if they've stopped paying interest on them. Mm-hmm. Often they will pay interest for a certain period of years after they actually mature, but then it stops at some point. So just go ahead and get those funds out. And my question would be, did you report interest on those along on your taxes?
No.
No. Okay. So then that would be some reportable income coming to you if that's just in a regular account.
Yeah. So that is one consideration. I wasn't exactly clear. If you're still working and that might – I don't know how much these are, but if declaring all of that interest over the past 20 or 30 years is going to be an expensive tax problem, whereas if you just waited a year or so and it was not a tax problem, that may be worth it. And just to zoom out a little bit for our audience, so the EE, the Series EE bonds, they are guaranteed to double in value in 20 years is the idea. I believe that number has changed in the past. But then it just earns at the interest rate that was established. Current interest rate is like 2.5%. But they only earn interest for 30 years. So if it's 30 years old, then you're not getting anything anymore. If it's 20 years old and the interest rate is still attractive, fine, great, go for it. We'll say kind of prevailing interest rates that you might get on a CD are also pretty attractive, so that would be part of your calculation. And then, as Nancy mentioned, you can put off paying tax on the interest until you cash it out. If you've done that, that means you've gathered interest, taxable interest, for a number of years, and you just want to be careful if that's going to be a large amount. For a lot of folks, you know, they have maybe a couple thousand dollars in Series EE bonds. That's not going to be an issue. But if you have a lot of interest gathered there, you might just want to give that one a second thought.
Yeah, well, since they're maturing over time, I was figuring I just might stop taking them out, you know, so that the interest hits kind of yearly but in small amounts.
Right. Okay, so you have multiple series of them. You have some maturing in different years. That does make sense, and that would be a good way of spreading out that income hit.
So my question is not about grocery, but rather about credit scores. So I'm close to needing to take out a mortgage and borrow money, and in preparation for that, I paid off some credit cards and sold, you know, a house and so forth. And I'm checking the three credit reporting agencies, and one of them reflected that, payoff of those debts and has a higher score, but the other two haven't showed it yet. So I'm wondering, do I need to wait for all three of them to reflect that, or can I request the mortgaging company to look at a particular credit reporting agency, or do I just need to hold on? I'm kind of not sure what to do at this point.
John, with any lender, they tend to rely on one agency over another. So certainly you can check as you start to shop for a loan for a house. You can ask the question of that lender, which service do you use, which do you rely on, and you can explain your situation. And it's possible they will go ahead and use the higher score because they want to give you the loan, unless there's something on there that would give them pause. So certainly just check with your lender about which one do they depend on more. Is that the one that you've already have seen that the score popped up? Or you can just explain your situation and see if they will go with that agency.
You're listening to Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson and Ryder Taff. Since we're out of the studio this morning, we're not taking phone calls. In this final segment of the show is a discussion about ways to stop wasting money.
If you overdraw your checking account and you're given, a fee, an overdraft fee, but you don't put any money in it, so it remains as a negative balance, does the bank continue to tack on overdrawn fees?
So they certainly can. I've actually had this experience. It wasn't an overdraft, but years ago I had a bank account that had an account minimum, And if you didn't maintain the minimum, then they would charge a $5 fee. And so they charged that fee every month. And they charged that fee every month. The minimum was, they said the minimum was $500, but I guess it was $500.01, because when they announced the minimum, I was like, okay, well, I'll top it up to exactly 500. Just to, it was a savings account. I didn't use it a lot. I'll just keep it open. It turns out it was $500.01. So 3 months later, I was like, hey guys, where'd my $15 go? And they're like, we took it. So that can happen. As far as overdraft fees, I think that usually happens at the transaction time. But again, there may be some other fees for negative balances. They may charge an interest rate for a negative balance. It's going to depend on the terms of that account. Some banks are notorious for kind of stacking your transactions in a way that's going to certainly appears that they are stacking transactions in a way such that they may incur more overdraft fees.
Nancy, and understand when you open an account, you are signing paperwork that's really a contract. And that paperwork says this is how this account will work, and you are agreeing to some of those charges. So my concern is if you just ignore this and just let it rock on, and as Ryder mentioned, having monthly charges hit you on top of the overdraft fee, is that something that will affect your credit? Because they'll say, but you owe that, and we're going to report that you didn't pay this off unless you clear it out. That could be a problem.
But so my advice for Luke is don't overdraft your bank account in the first place. Don't spend money that you don't actually have. And that can be difficult. Sometimes it is just a matter of timing those cash flows. You know, if your paycheck comes in, 2 days late because of the 4th of July holiday, but your bill comes in a day early because of the 4th of July holiday. I mean, that can be really tricky, and managing that. Managing that can be tough.
Number two on the list of things to stop buying to save money, and this one I think I totally agree with, the extended warranty. So, Nancy, any thoughts on, do you think these are valuable?
No, I am not a fan of extended warranties. We have clients who love them, and they love to tell me about that one time that warranty paid off big. Remember, this is just insurance, and you buy insurance to cover things that you can't cover yourself. So most of the time, an extended warranty, for instance, on a toaster or a small oven that sits on your countertop, you don't need those. If they break, you're probably going to get a new one. So there are all kinds of things like that they are always pushing to upsell you with buy the product, now buy the extended warranty because you know something could happen. But many of these products already have some warranties built in for a certain period of time that will cover the major things. And so I am just not a fan of adding those on. I don't think they're valuable.
If you get an extended warranty, for example, like you mentioned, on a toaster, do you have to – so you call them up. You say, hey, my toaster broke. Do they send out a toaster repair person? You got to get on the calendar for the toaster. Some guy comes by. He says, I'm going to have to look at that. Let me come back next week. You know, what is the toaster repair warranty process look like? And all jokes aside, one of the things we talk about a lot of times, we talk about credit cards as a tool for managing your spending. That's already come up once, talking about overdraft fees. That can help you manage your cash flows there. Again, as long as you're not putting more money on your credit card than you can actually pay. Often credit cards have extended warranty benefits. So one, that can be something you look for when you get a credit card. It's very common, I think. And you can also just call your credit card company, say, oh, I bought this computer, I bought this XYZ, because things will have some warranty built in, some return policy, whatever. But often they can extend for a year. I have seen some that maybe extend it to 2 years. I've actually made use of one, something I bought at a camera store and needed a repair, and that the credit card warranty and ended up helping me save a couple bucks then.
Good morning, Kay. You're on the air with us, so go ahead.
Good morning, y'all. I have totally enjoyed your musing on today's show, but I did want to call with a question. I recently had my credit debit card compromised, and so I'm in the market to get a new credit card. I would like to find one with no annual fee and one that would give me a payback at the end of the year. Can you all suggest one?
Yes. So there's a number of pretty good sites for searching through credit card offers. I would say one I reference a lot is nerdwallet.com. But there are a number of, as far as just kind of simple, no fee, decent rewards. I personally prefer just the cash back rewards just because you can just put it towards your next bill and you get the money immediately. You don't have to think, oh, am I going to upgrade my flight or do this specific thing or get early access to this concert ticket or something. So I know a lot of banks, I think Citi with the double cash was the first one to do just a free annual, no annual fee, 2% cash back on just basically everything. You don't have to worry about categories or anything like that. If uh-huh. you already,
and which one was that?
So I believe Citi offers that. I don't know. I don't remember if it's a MasterCard or a Visa or something.
Okay. I'll check it up.
But and that one doesn't require you to say, oh, I'm spending this on travel, I'm spending this on gasoline, or spending on certain categories, just 2% flat back. I think, and a lot of places do have one like that. But compare cards, of course. And also, if you already have a relationship with a credit card company, you enjoyed their customer service, you already enjoyed them. A lot of times in a situation like you where your card is compromised, they may be willing to give you essentially just the same card with a new number. You don't have to necessarily move to a whole different provider just to keep your identity or keep your information safe. Credit card companies are very good about fraud detection and prevention. And so calling them just to work on that would be the first step. And they may offer a card that's very attractive to you too.
Another site is creditcard.com. And when you go to that site, it allows you to put in what your parameters are and how you use your card and whether it's cash back that's important to you or no fee. And so it will spit out a whole list of options for you, and you want to compare those. If you like to have some amount roll over from month to month, meaning you will be paying interest charges, you're looking for the lowest interest charge card. Otherwise, look for the best deal.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. Let's take one more item off our list of things to stop buying to save money. This one hits home for me, too. It's knickknacks. So I know I collect a lot of different things. And I'll say this. To me, it's fun going to flea markets, toy conventions, that sort of thing, and looking for specific things of the item that you happen to collect. In my case, the Marvel Comics figure Thor is what I like, and I probably have, about 50 different ones. But and I will agree that once you kind of get them there, they're just sitting on a shelf. But to me, the fun is involved in the hunt for what you're collecting.
Oh, that's right up Nancy's alley. The fun is in the hunt. Go for
it.
Tell them all about it.
And it, you know, I think if there's something that really brings you pleasure.
Yes.
And the only thing that I'm learning to do at this stage, Kevin, is to edit a little bit. And so I'm trying to do the one in, one out. So if there's something that I just think, this is just the cutest little thing and I want it sitting on my shelf is already full. And so I need
What are you going to get rid of? Yeah. And I think this is really good. And it kind of ties in with what you said, you know, the books might be controversial. It's sometimes there is a thing like that that we really do care about. Nancy and Kevin, they clearly love the thrill of the hunt for their knickknacks. They care about their knickknacks. Maybe they need to create some rules around that. But and for me, I have my bad habit, quote unquote. I'm not going to call any spending bad. I'm not going to attach some like moral judgment to it. But, you know, I could probably trim down my spending on books. But if it's something that truly does bring you joy, you really value it, and you're willing to say, okay, I know I can cut my, me personally, I could cut my knickknack budget out in exchange for a higher book budget. Kevin may cut his book budget for a higher knickknack budget. For instance, if it's something you can do that, you know, give yourself that permission. That's okay. Your spending should bring you joy.
Thanks for joining us this morning for this Best Of episode of Money Talks. Remember that you can always send an email with your personal finance questions to money@mpbonline.org. This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.